Session 121, Salt Lake City, 2006, Sunstone. Lengthen your stride, the administration of Spencer W. Kimball. Our speaker today is Edward Kimball, son of President Kimball. I'll briefly go over his resume, and we're having a little bit of feedback system with our thing, so if you'll help us with that, we'll get started. I'm to remind everybody to enter with a ticket and to remove your noisy telephones and so forth. Edward Kimball is a professor emeritus from the Reuben Law School at Brigham Young University. He's had an active career in writing. He's the editor of Faith Precedes a Miracle and the Teachings of Spencer W. Kimball. He's a co-author of Spencer W. and Camilla Kimball. He's the author recently of Lengthen Your Stride, The Presidency of Spencer W. Kimball. I've read this book. It was delightful and one that I value very much in my library. When we're finished and our session is slated for 1 hour, we will award Ed a half hour to 45 minutes or whatever he feels he needs to take, and then hopefully this microphone will be working fine for questions. Please come up and speak in that microphone for questions. Ed.
Good morning. I'm pleased to be here and appreciate your attendance. It shows an interest in the subject that is, of course, dear to my heart. What I propose to do is to talk a little bit about the sequence of events, not in a particularly chronological order, but in a topical manner, of the things that occurred during the presidency of Spencer W. Kimball, which began in late December of 1973 and continued until November of 1985, 12 years, almost exactly 12 years later. It was a time of substantial growth in the church, and a lot of things changed. But let me remind you of what was going on in the rest of the world during that period of 12 years, some of the events that you'll remember. For example, in 1974, Watergate was on the front pages of our newspapers. In South Africa, apartheid was beginning to come to an end. In 1976, Mao Zedong died in China, opening the doors to a more open China with some nod towards the capitalistic system. Israel and Egypt signed an accord, and Mount St. Helens exploded, the greatest volcanic eruption in the United States during historic times. AIDS was first identified as a major health issue during this period. And at the end of it, Solidarity, the union in Poland, struck, was knocked down by the Soviet military force, but sprung up again. And so that was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. This is a Cold War era, and that colored a lot of what happened. There were a lot of things that we take for granted now that hadn't yet happened. One of those things was the internet did not yet exist, so that which is so universal in our use was not yet available. There was the further disintegration of the Soviet Union. It was the seams were beginning to show, but it had not yet come to the collapse that came along about 4 years after Dad's death. Other major developments had begun and continued, but had not yet reached their culmination. For example, a movement toward racial equality, increased feminist interests, the scope of the AIDS epidemic in the world, the resultant flood of pornography that came with the institution of the internet. And so those are things that were yet in the future. One thing I learned in working my way through these materials is that whereas we sometimes assume that things in the church that are come to us as new programs sort of are born full grown, but by looking behind the scenes a little, you see that there are programs or events that look that way, but that had their foundation long before. For example, in 1975, we had the announcement of a new temple for Sao Paulo in Brazil, a major new movement in temple building. Smaller temples scattered throughout the world. But that had been discussed for years beforehand. Elder Hinckley had been to South America looking for a site for the building of it, for example. So there are lots of things that occurred during this period that had their premise before that. Then many things that were discussed during that 12-year period did not come to fruition until after the death of Spencer Kimball. And then I discovered there's some things that were interesting that never did happen publicly. There was a substantial debate in the high quorums of the church about whether to have a policy against viewings of dead bodies at the time of the funeral. Well, they discussed that at great length and had disagreements and finally decided not to have a policy. So that sort of never reached the surface. In his first press conference, shortly after he became president, Spencer Kimball said, "I don't anticipate any major changes. I've been a participant in the quorums of the church for 30 years now, since 1943. That's 30 years, and so he had been a participant in that. And there were no particular plans to change things. Your laughter tells me you recognize that was short-sighted on his part. Things began to change very quickly. The first significant address that he made was to the regional representatives. He became president of the church at the very last days of 1973. Come April, he met with the regional representatives. This was at the at April conference. And in that, he set out a program missionary work, in which he actually graphically pointed out on a world chart how the missionaries from Korea would be enough to serve in Korea and have a surplus that would spill over to teach in Asia and so on. This almost military description of the armies of the East and the West encircling the earth with the gospel was very striking in the eyes of those who were there. Let me read to you the description that Grant Bangerter wrote. An author is always delighted, a biographer is always delighted if you can find somebody else who make a nice pithy statement that suits your purposes. As he proceeded with his address, he had not spoken very long when a new awareness seemed suddenly to fall on the congregation. We became alert to an astonishing spiritual presence, and we realized that we were listening to something unusual, powerful, different from any of our previous meetings. It was as if spiritually our hair began to stand on end. Our minds were suddenly vibrant and marveling at the transcendent message that was coming to our ears. With a new perceptiveness, we realized the present Kimball was opening spiritual windows and beckoning us to come and gaze with him on the plans of eternity. It was as if he were drawing back the curtains which covered the purpose of the Almighty and inviting us to view with him the destiny of the gospel and the vision of its ministry." Wow, I wouldn't dare write that. But anyway, the point is, that was interesting to me about this is that a year earlier, while he was president of the Quorum of the Twelve and Harold B. Lee was president of the church, he had given almost the same sermon to the regional representatives as a representative of the missionary effort of the church. At that time, it sort of rolled off people, the duck's back. What was different this time? I think it was two things. One, it was that he was now the chief spokesman, and people having a reverence for that position listened with a little different tuning. It wasn't just a person speaking, it was sort of the person speaking. But beyond that, I think there was probably, though I wasn't there, there was probably I don't want to say authoritativeness, confidence. I mean, he set out now a program for us to follow, and that was a departure from this self-effacing personality that he had. He didn't put himself forward, but he certainly was a strong proponent of the church program. You can take pretty much any number, statistical number of the church, beginning with its population, its membership, and say over that 12 years it nearly doubled. Nearly doubled the number of endowments in the temple, nearly doubled the number of names that were cleared for temple work, the population of the church nearly doubled, the missionary service nearly doubled, not quite. And so on. You go down the list, the number of stakes was more than doubled. So it was a period of rapid growth, and one of the characteristics was that if you draw a graph starting with the years before Spencer Kimball, then you see a tilt upward during those 12 years. And for some respects, it continued to be tilted upward. So it was a time when growth was both the boon and the bane of the church. What do you do when within a few years you have double the number of church leaders who need to be trained, where you have to absorb double the number of members into the community? Those are things that he was aware of and sought to attend to. Specifically with respect to missionary work, the numbers were 17,000 missionaries when he started. They were 29,000 when he ended. It is not as though he suddenly created a new missionary enthusiasm. He added to what already was there. He pushed for every young man to be worthy and serve a mission. Surely that was the expectation before then, the hope at least. And this was a thing on which he was heard repeatedly, that it was a part of the religious obligation of young men to give this kind of service and to be worthy so that they could do it. But he also stressed more than had previously been stressed the encouragement of young women to serve missions and couples to serve missions. During this time, for example, there was a substantial growth in medical missionary service. Nurses and doctors who, coming to a place in their career when they could do that, would go to places far removed from their usual work to serve as missionaries, looking after the health of the people. Another emphasis of his during this time was that missionary service is not just an obligation of those in, quote, Zion. That is, up to this time, the percentage of missionaries who came from other than the United States and Canada was rather small. But by the end of his administration, 30% of all the missionaries were coming from other places. He said in one of the South American countries, do you know any reason why I should send my sons on missions, but you shouldn't send yours? He put it to them that this was part of a universal obligation and not just a U.S.-Canada where the church was more well established, but it was everybody's. With respect to the percentage of young men who served missions, by the end of his administration, it was ranging between 25% and 30%. You might wish that it was higher still, but that was as high as it had ever been. There was a spike during David O. McKay's administration where it got up briefly to 30% and then for various reasons declined again. But now it was staying up in the 25 to 30% range. There was an effort on his part also to expand, consistent with his talk to the regional representatives, to expand the reach of missionary service into new places. And he called David Kennedy who had been U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. No, is that right?
NATO.
Yeah, to NATO? No, I don't know. Anyway, who had also been Secretary of the Treasury, and he called him to be essentially a church ambassador, to go to places in the world where the church had not been established and to see what he could do to open the doors. In 1974, this is a year during the first year of his administration, there was an area conference in Stockholm. And at the end of the conference, he said to Kennedy, where are you going now? And he said he was going home. And he said, why don't you go by way of Portugal and open that as a missionary effort? Well, Kennedy did just that. He knew some people in the Portuguese government, and by talking to one who referred him to another, he obtained audience with the man who was in the position to have an influence in the church. The church had only a handful of people who were members in that country. And there was a rule that there weren't, I forget the number, but anyway, we didn't have enough church members to establish a church under the existing law. Kennedy said to Zinha, but you're still ruling by military decree, are you not? So what you say works. And he said, yes, I guess that's true. So he said, then why don't you just decree that the pre-existing law that limited more access to the country to those with already a substantial membership there, that no longer applies? He said yes, and said, well, that should apply to all churches then, shouldn't it? Answer, yes. So in the stroke of a pen, basically, that country was open at least to a limited extent, and missionaries were sent from Brazil, where they speak Portuguese. And within a few months, there were a handful of missionaries who were beginning the work there. So it was that kind of thing of opening doors that was part of his effort and part of his legacy. In 1977, Kennedy was able to procure recognition of the church by the Polish government, and Dad went to Poland to open the missionary effort there by offering a dedicatory prayer in the park while the Secret Service was watching and listening. This was not a carte blanche to do anything the church wished, but it did open the doors, and over a period of years they got more and more access until they could actually do proselyting work in the traditional way. Well, this is growth then that is in the missionary field. Some other smaller things are kind of interesting to me. At the beginning of his administration, if you had a child as a missionary, as we did, you sent the money to the missionary and then deducted it on your income tax because the church was going to be the beneficiary of this. Well, the IRS didn't see it that way and said that, no, what you're doing is you're making a gift to your child, and then they are using it to support themselves. So the church, in order to avoid the tax issue, said, instead of sending money to your own sons, you give the money to the ward, and the ward, having discretion to spend it any way they wish, as far as you're concerned, knows what you'd like done, and they will then do it. They will send the money on to your child. Led to the ward then sending to somebody in Mexico $80, and to somebody in Alaska, $400 or $500. And the disparity in that led ultimately, after Dad's time, to the equalization so that all missionaries, the parents or the families of missionaries provide the same amount, and the church then equalizes the cost. But those are some of the smaller details that occurred that made the system work. Another major innovation was in 1975, the creation or reinstitution of the First Quorum of the 70. You have to be kind of aware of church administration to have a sense of how important that was. And this is one of those things that had been talked about for many, many years below the surface of our consciousness, those of us ordinary members of the church. But now it finally broke the surface. And it was a major announcement in the fall of 1975 that the first quorum of the 70 would be constituted. And shortly after that, the assistants to the 12, who had served somewhat the same function, but not with the focus on missionary work that the 70 had, they were absorbed into the quorum of the 70. And the quorums of the 70 have expanded now until we are dealing with large, large numbers. And when they put in the church news a picture of all the general authorities, you know, it fills double page with little tiny pictures. The difference in the, and I'm oversimplifying, the difference in the functions of the first quorum of the 70 is that before that, they were sort of general authorities who had special focus on missionary work. But after they were constituted as a quorum, they shifted their emphasis to a church administration. And for example, somebody to look over the church history department would be then a 70, and nothing special to do with missionary work there. The church was divided into areas, and the members of the quorum of the 12 had overall supervision, but the 70 had more detailed supervision over the many regions or areas they were called of the church. There was, in this process of naming more and more general authorities into the quorum of the 70 and then subsequent additional quorums of 70, that this allowed for and encouraged a lot of diversity. And so you had the first non-Caucasian general authorities, for example, and the foreigners from Canada. That isn't really foreign, is it? From Belgium and from the Netherlands and from Brazil. And all of these things are one of the ways in which the church reached out into the world and became more nearly what we could call an international church. There's still some blank spots on the map as far as effective church missionary work is being done, but certainly the naming of people with foreign-sounding names, different color skin, was a major change that took place beginning in this era. Another change relating to church administration was the creation of an emeritus status. It had been talked about since at least the 1950s, but here again there was the willingness, indeed eagerness, to make a change that would make the things more effective, so that those who were 70 or in ill health were honorably released and did not continue to occupy a position. Now, that did not apply to the Quorum of the 12 and the First Presidency, because they were perceived as having the keys already for the prophetic role, and it was not thought appropriate to take them out of that line of succession. But in any event, for all the other general authorities, an emeritus status was instituted in 1978. Eldred G. Smith, the patriarch of the church, who still is in that position today, was given emeritus status, and no one was called to replace him. And so, in effect, the office of patriarch to the church has gone into a kind of it exists in name, but is not presently in operation. E. Gary Smith, his son, has written about that experience and the history behind it. And I encourage you to look at the book about the patriarchy. Another change in administration was the delegation to stake presidents of a lot of things that had previously been the province of the general authorities, things like ordaining bishops, ordaining patriarchs, ordaining 70. The loss of the office of 70 as a local thing occurred in President Benson's time. So during this period, there still were 70s quorums in the stakes of the church, and they were now, after this delegation to the state presidents, more perceived of as a local rather than as a more general office. Okay, that's all I'm going to say right now about the administrative side of things. The temples. This 12-year period was a surprising time for the building of temples. When President Kimball took office, the Washington, D.C. temple was under construction and was dedicated by him in the summer of 1974. And after that, it was as a whoosh. Things took off with respect to temple building. The D.C. temple was the first that had been built for a number of years. It was a marvelous temple, and we haven't seen the like since, because it was sort of a big-scale effort. What happened during this 12 years was the breaking down in the size of temples and the increase in number. It was consistent with a concerted effort of President Kimball to take the church to the people instead of, as had for years been drawing the people to Zion to build up the strength of the church in the central area. That had long since been substituted by a preachment that people ought to stay where they are. But that was hard for people to be persuaded. Now, if the temples were being put in Switzerland or in Mexico, there was not the same reason for them to come to Utah or other places in the American West. Just in numbers, I said that many things doubled during that 12 years. At the beginning of this administration, there were 15 operating temples. And at the end of this time, there were 47. This is in a 12-year period, there were 47 temples being used, under construction, or announced. In other words, that much was the commitment. A tremendous burst of temples. And that surprised me. My father had never had very much in terms of special assignment to temple work. The missionary work, he had been chairman of the church missionary committee for years. He had been working with the church budgeting and so on. There were many areas in which he had personal experience. But the responsibility for temple building was, as far as I was aware, something new to his emphasis. And I take that as an indication that there was somebody else telling him what to do. That it was not particularly something he had set out to do. It was not one of the things he listed in this first press conference as on his to-do list. The cost of these many new temples was a major consideration. This was a great drain on church resources. But in talking to church financial officer about that, he said he thought it was not a loss financially, but that the increased activity, increased tithes that were coming consistent with the existence and growth of temple worship was such that the church probably gained. At least it didn't lose in terms of its ability to build. Indeed, it was during this period also that the payment for chapel building, which had in previous years, I remember contributing to many chapels in different places, trying to raise 30% or 40% of the cost locally. During this administration, the amount that had to be raised locally was down to 4%. And of course, since then, it's zero. But that was a significant change. And it was just after, and probably discussed during the administration, that the local expenses were paid for by the central church. So in some ways, this is an era of decentralization, of, for example, delegation to the state presidents. But then it was also, in another way, a centralization of some things, like financing. That was that became more instead of less. Another difference in the temple area was a change in garment style, for which I'm ever grateful. If those of you who are old enough to remember, the old garment styles were not nearly so congenial. But it was a willingness to make adjustments that seemed in the best interest of the church. Another change that I think may have slipped by, not much noticed, was a change in the questions asked in receiving a recommend. Before this time, the questions largely focused on conduct. Are you honest in your dealings? Are you a full tithe payer? And so on. Do you support the president of the church? In 1985, at the very end of this administration, the questions were enlarged to ask more questions of testimony, of faith, about commitment to the principles of belief in the restored gospel. And so there was a little shift from emphasis on conduct to testimony. We went through an interesting shift in conference structure. Some of these are details, but to me they signify the ongoing effort to try to adjust things to a changing population, to a changing society. A general conference used to be 3 days and always include the 6th of April when the church was organized. That was sometimes inconvenient when the 6th of April fell on Wednesday, so you'd have to have Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday, or you'd have to have Wednesday, Friday. No, they always did it on Sunday, so if it was on Wednesday, you had to. Anyway, now it's two days of sessions instead of three, and it doesn't always include the 6th of April. Area conferences. There had been one a year for 3 years before the administration. In the first year of when he was in charge, it was scaled up from one a year to seven in 1975. And in total, during the years that he was active, there were 66 total area conferences. Well, that's just a big meeting in a stadium someplace, except for all the people who were there, maybe tens of thousands of people in some cases were present at those meetings in whether it be Brazil or South Africa or somewhere. These were occasions to see the leadership of the church in person, even though it might be 50 yards away. They felt in the presence of important people in the Lord's eyes. And so it was a major spiritual experience for the people in those 66 congregations to actually have the president there to talk to them. So it was another aspect of this taking the church to the people, just as with building of many smaller temples. Solemn assemblies, not scheduled regularly, but during his years of administration, there were at least 58 solemn assemblies conducted. Some of you may not know what a solemn assembly of this sort is. There's a solemn assembly every time a new president is sustained, they call it. But then this was also sort of a special solemn assembly where he would go to a region, say Northern Utah, up in Logan. They would meet in the temple with all of the local church leaders and have sort of a private session where they would discuss things that they wouldn't normally talk about in a general conference for the public. One day I remember he had a solemn assembly in Logan in the morning, Salt Lake City in the afternoon, Provo area or Southern Utah area people in the evening. So that was each session was about 3 to 4 hours. So that was a busy day, but the whole point of it, of course, was the directness of involvement by the church hierarchy with the leadership at the local level. I attended one of those, and it was an interesting experience. It was it had a sort of a feeling of just us guys here talking about the important things of the church. The auxiliary conferences, once a year by each of the auxiliaries, the Sunday School, the MIA, the Relief Society, That was abolished. They stopped having those because the church was getting too big. It was only a select few who were able to come to Salt Lake and participate in those conferences, and so they stopped having them in 1975. State conferences used to be four times a year, and when I was young, used to have always two general authorities, four times a year. During this period, state conferences dropped down to two times a year, and general authority presence was rare, not rare, but not routine. Regional conferences began to take the place of some state conferences where you could get an auditorium like Marriott Center in Provo. You could have a conference that would reach from several general authorities, could go and meet with several stakes at the same time. So it was again a way of economizing on manpower resources. The use of satellite broadcast was begun in this era too. There were about half of the stakes equipped with big dishes at the end of this period, and the remainder of the stakes were soon afterwards equipped with those big dishes, and the church then began to have general meetings of the whole church, or at least of large parts of the church, by satellite, and that of course has increased. And when the auxiliary conferences were abandoned, there was substituted for it a little different way of cutting the membership. There were conference sessions for the women of the church. And then there was a conference session annually for the young women of the church. And of course, the men and the priesthood had always had their separate session, but these are sessions that were now church-level major conferences. Okay, the conference structure was in itself, the changes in themselves were, I think, not so great, except as they symbolized and exemplified growth, effort to maintain closeness in spite of the ever-spreading membership of the church. When am I supposed to be through?
Three or four more minutes.
Oh boy, you're going to... All right, I'll try. The welfare system. Again, until I had really looked at this, I hadn't realized how much change there had. During this period, there was a buildup of the church welfare system, an acquiring of farms. And I remember picking cherries and apples on the church welfare farms in our community. During this period, it was realized that there was no way that the church could have enough resources of this sort to feed any large percentage of the church. And so the farms were largely sold off or put under professional management and kept as a resource for economic advantage. Where I used to pick cherries is now filled with office buildings, and I think the church benefited financially by selling off the farms. But what the shift was then to an emphasis on individual responsibility to improve your education, your employability, to store food for your own use and for that of your neighbors, and so on. But so the welfare system changed. In that respect, there was a dramatic opportunity to put it to the test when the Teton Dam collapsed and the whole area near Rexburg, Idaho, was inundated, and there were only a few deaths, but tremendous property damage, and the church welfare system, confronted with a major disaster in its own backyard, was able to have trucks loaded with supplies on site within a day or two. Another opportunity to show the church's increasing humanitarian view of its responsibility were the two fasts held in which about $10 million was raised in those two fasts for humanitarian aid in Africa during a time of drought and famine there. Well, in time that's limited, I'm going to just tick off a laundry list of other things. The Indian Student Placement Program, which had been one of Spencer Kimball's favorite projects, began to dwindle and has since disappeared. The new Bible published by the church and a new triple combination were now available. There was a canonization of two new sections to the Doctrine and Covenants. With respect to security, this was the beginning, really, of a need for security at a different level than had existed before. With Harold B. Lee, there was the beginnings of somebody going with the president to guard him against assault. But Irville LeBaron, I think, is responsible for a major change in that. And if you watch the president today, there's someone at his elbow who's looking suspiciously like the Secret Service, who has a kind of a, like a notebook, you know, a thing, but it'll fold out to be a shield to ward off bullets if necessary. I mean, this is serious because, for example, Irville LeBaron, who died in prison, is supposed to have caused, not by his own action, but by delegate's action, the death of 28 people, the most recent of which was when there were two men killed because of their loss of allegiance, and a child killed because she was a witness to the first killings. So this was real stuff, and I can't resist illustrating it in one more way. There was a returned missionary who had mental problems who was found in the St. George parking lot, the St. George Temple parking lot, when Dad went there, who had a rifle. And he was then committed again to the mental hospital for treatment for a while, released as cured. And shortly after that, when Dad was in St. George again, he was found hiding in a car in the parking lot with a shotgun. I mean, it's almost funny, but it isn't funny because it means this is a different era, a different world. There is danger where there didn't used to be danger. Corporate directorships. Dad resigned from most of the corporate directorships that he was originally heir to, and thought he had better things to do with his time. President Hinckley has expanded that to indicate that all the general authorities no longer are to spend their time with corporate directorships. The Equal Rights Amendment was a major political, social, public relations factor during a number of years during this period. It was a time of turmoil with respect to that issue. The church took an active political role in opposing it and raised a great deal of clamor against and opposition, many thinking that it was an inappropriate issue for the church to focus on. And you're going to have to. Well, maybe somebody could take the floor and then, you know, like they do in Congress. Let me have a minute.
How many people would like questions for? Why don't you speak for 5 minutes more?
Thank you. Howard Hughes' will. Another public relations opportunity. The church got good publicity basically from that. Mark Hoffman's forgeries. Bad publicity. The MX missile statement. Mixed. The church took a position that the MX missile should not be based in the Utah-Nevada desert, but also, which people saw less, at the same time said inferentially that it shouldn't be built anywhere. We need a better solution than to try to hide 200 atomic warhead missiles in 4,200 shelters, so that it was a shell game of where are the missiles. But that was part of the Cold War. And this whole era is, the Cold War is going on. All of these things are taking place during that. Chapel construction I mentioned. 5 chapters in the book on Lengthen Your Stride are devoted to the revelation on priesthood. I wouldn't begin to try to encompass what I said in the book in the time that's remaining for me. If you're interested in that, as I hope you are, you'll read what I've written. I have given you all that I am aware of in terms of the background and the way in which it came to pass. I can say that there's nothing about that administration for which I am personally more grateful and more appreciative of it, as indicative of a kind of humility and openness, a willingness to change that is reflected by that. Well, now Jake wants you to ask questions.
Use the microphone for your questions and try to make your question short and your answer short so everybody can.
Among my colleagues at work, there was unbridled enthusiasm for the change in the priesthood policy and a different perspective by and large on the Equal Rights Amendment. However, in terms of public relations for the church, the big problem with the Equal Rights Amendment, I think, as manifested by my colleagues at work, was the fact that the church seemed to be operating with a double standard here. The statement was made, the church does not dictate how people are to vote. They're free to vote any way they want. But on the other hand, I'm aware of some people who had their temple recommends lifted over their sponsorship of the ERA. That ended up, amongst my friends, being a real black eye in the public image of the church. This sounds like a hostile question, but I don't mean it that way. I just don't know how else to express it. What was your dad's point of view on saying one thing publicly but doing something else privately?
Yeah, I think it was a matter of defining what was acceptable and what was not acceptable. People who had their temple recommends lifted should not have suffered that consequence except if they were acting in a way that was perceived as antagonistic to the church, not simply disagreeing with whether the ERA should be adopted. You may say that's disingenuous, but I think that's the way that it was perceived by the church leadership, is that say whatever you want, but the ERA is good. But what you shouldn't do is say that the church has no business speaking in this area. Try. Barnard?
President Kimball reigns supreme, in my judgment, as seeking those that were out of the way and being able to relate to them individually and personally in such a prophetic way. In your growing up with your father as your father, did you perceive this inclination or ability within him to also reach out to those that were out of the way before he became prophet?
Well, he was all his life a lover of people. He was a people person. If there was a group with him or around him. If there was a party, he was the center of the party. And if there were stories being told, he was among them. But I didn't have all that much opportunity to see what you're asking for. I know of some instances. For example, there were some illiterates who were working on the canal construction, irrigation canal construction. He was the secretary of the canal company. They were paid. They didn't know how to write their name, and so he helped them learn how to sign their name. I mean, that's petty, but it simply shows that he didn't push away people who had even a simple need like that. Anyway, I'll just give you the conclusion. Whatever, if I could think of some more instances, I tell you they would all support your view that he was good with people. In the book, there are several instances that talk about him being in a group and reaching out to somebody who was on the periphery. There was a man who was a non-member, not a member of the church. He was in Amsterdam. He was with Dad coming out of a meeting, seeing this man standing alone, leaves the crowd and walks over to him and greets him and makes his acquaintance. In that particular case, that turned out to be a crucial factor in his accepting membership in the church. But the point is that Dad seemed able to leave this group and go find the one who was out there on the periphery, as you say.
I'm just appreciative of the perspective that you have about President Kimball's administration, as well as, given the research that you've done, what documents are available. In that context, my question is this: what do you see as particularly promising areas for research, for future research on President Kimball's administration?
I have no answer. If you can give me more of a clue, a cue, I may be able to respond better.
Well, in other words, obviously you've chosen to write about, probably more about President Kimball's administration than anyone else.
Yes.
Maybe by default. You also are aware of what records are available and what records are not accessible. Are there particular topics that you think are particularly waiting to be... both worthy topics as well as, given the accessibility of the documents, topics that...
Oh, dear. I'm embarrassed, but I really can't tell you. I can tell you what documents there are. The sources, primary sources for this book were my father's journals and some of his correspondence. I didn't have access to his official correspondence at the church office building, but only his private correspondence. My own observations, of course, account for a good deal of the sort of the personal, private stuff. I apologize. I'm just not able to help you much.
Is there a book you wish someone would write?
Well, I've written all the books I expect to write. No, I'm going to now write the story of Andrew Kimball, my father's father. That's just sort of a personal project. I don't think any of you will want to read that, but I will.
In the July 1976 Ensign, your father wrote a First Presidency message entitled "The False Gods We Worship," mm-hmm. and that for me has become a touchstone of moral statement about what it means to be a practicing disciple of the Master. Among the false gods he mentioned are the traditional sorts of things like, you know, money and so on. One in particular that struck me at the time as a student at the University was of Utah. When I got my hands on the article, it was right when the debate over the MX missile was going forward, and he came out with his statement, which he addresses specifically in that 1976 article, where he talks about the false god of militarism mm-hmm. that we look to for support. And given you know the trend in national policy and other things of that nature at this time, it's been something that's reemerged as a focus. And I'm wondering if you have any personal insight or recollections about that side of your father that were manifested in the anti-MX missile statement, but in addition, not so much a call for pacifism, but for the anti-militarism that was explicit in that article.
The article's in 76, the missile statement was in 81, so that's a 5-year difference. I'm not sure that's significant, but it was then. My father didn't volunteer for the Army in the First World War. He was drafted. He didn't serve because in those days they convened contingents, and he, by the time that his contingent was gathered together, the war was over. But he was not a pacifist that I ever sensed, but he also thought that there was much too much expended in terms of money and life over wars that didn't need to be fought. The sentiments that are expressed in the 76 article were not new. I mean, you go back even phrases of that you'll find in earlier talks. But it, I think it sort of stood out because of its being, one, because of its being focus, you know, the first presidency message, basically. And the other reason that is that it's been quoted a lot. You know, it's a favorite quotation for people who share his view that militarism is the road to disaster. And when he says, the Lord will fight our battles, I don't honestly know how literal that means. I mean, we say, if the enemy is coming, we don't defend ourselves because the Lord will protect us? Or does it mean something less? He didn't give a final answer on the issues of pacifism, is what I'm trying to say. That is one of the false gods that we worship. We're seeing some of the consequences of that today in our experience.
I'm going to ask one quick question because I'm the moderator and I deserve one, and then we'll ask for a brief answer and then we'll be excused. Just before President Kimball was ordained prophet, I guess Harold B. Lee's administration okayed the new Mormon history movement in 1972, wherein young historians were hired. Some, I think, are in the audience today. This was called 10 Years in Camelot because a lot of new Mormon history was being written. And then, rather unceremoniously, Leonard Arrington was moved from the position and sent away to Provo, which I understand kind of broke his heart. And inasmuch as this era was presided over by President Kimball, and I know President Kimball personally assigned Leonard Arrington to write Brigham Young American Moses, was President Kimball in agreement that some of this history was not faith promoting, or was he in opposition to Brother Benson and Brother Packer and others who felt it was? Why did he let these changes and the closing down of the archives occur? Was it because he was elderly and they did it in spite of him? Or what was his role and attitude toward that?
And you're asking me for a short answer?
30 seconds.
it's a puzzle, actually. I can only make a stab at it. From everything I know, he was favorably disposed towards the activities of the so-called New Mormon history. Leonard Arrington was someone whom he personally admired and whom he trusted to do the job in a way that was a credit both to his profession and to his church. There was opposition by some of the other general authorities to a sort of a secularist explanation for some of the events in church history. My father seems to have ducked confrontation with them, sort of letting things take their course, and not speaking up, not speaking out. His kind of attitude was one looking for unanimity, looking for agreement, and while he did not positively push some things forward, I think he also tried to avoid pushing them backwards, sort of letting them find a natural level. If he'd asked my advice, I would have given some different answers, but he didn't ask my advice.
Thank you.